You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen. And this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is David Just. David, it's good to have you here this morning.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
I get a little hyper on this. It's funny. My son teases me about my radio voice. Anyway, so which sometimes kicks in and sometimes I can live without it, and most people can live without it. So David, the purpose of the show is to help us get to know the people of the region, and also maybe even to kind of to model how we might ask questions of each other in ways that are direct but not too intrusive. So who are you, and what do we need to know to start this conversation?
Sure, that's a really big question.
Yes.
And I in answering, I guess they're sort of three qualities that I'd like to think about as sort of my core qualities, if you will. And
sure.
I the first of those really is just being driven. I actually in thinking about this show asked my wife, how would you describe me?
Uh-huh.
The first thing she said
that's
is
a very good exercise.
Yes. Yeah, once in a while you should ask your spouse what they think of you. But the first thing she says is you're very driven, and I think that comes from my upbringing. My father comes from a German household, and some of it bled off on me, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's displayed through a lot of my history. I got my undergrad degree in 3 years. I was able to complete a PhD in 3 years, and I when I set goals, I set them and I accomplished them as quickly as I can.
Right. Wow.
Right. The other, and you know, so that's a good thing, I think, generally, but not always, and you can ask my wife about that. As well, I think of service mm-hmm. as something that's very, very important to me. It wasn't always. I sort of began to appreciate serving others as a teenager.
Uh-huh.
And started to realize, you know, that you get a lot out of doing things for other people. And I've tried to keep this sort of ethic in my life I'm a Mormon, so this is a very Mormon ethic.
Mm-hmm.
When people ask me to do things for service, if I have the ability to, I do it. Mm-hmm. Right, I say yes. I try my best never to say no when I've got the ability to help somebody out, and that's not always possible, and not always I don't always live up to that. But it's something that I try to keep as a guiding principle
mm-hmm.
to what I do.
Sure.
And I guess the last sort of pillar is something that really only matured in maybe the last few years. I see a real importance in mentoring people.
Mm-hmm.
This happened both professionally and also, you know, sort of socially. I've started to recognize more and more people coming to me and asking me for advice on what to do in their life and in their career or you know, whatever situation they might be in. I started to realize people actually liked it when I would share some of my experiences and sort of give them an idea of how I was able to solve certain problems in my life and how they could help do some of the same things. So I think there's sort of the three guiding things mm-hmm. in my life.
That's really neat. That's really neat. And I think this mentoring piece, I mean, mentoring has become a big buzzword in the last 15 years, and partly it's the absence of a sense of community either in our workplace or in our residential life, and we are seeking it.
Yeah.
Again, and it's a very powerful thing.
And it's funny because one of the things that really pushed me that direction, I was called to serve as the leader of the Mormon congregation in Ithaca several years ago. I'm no longer in that role,
and it is a volunteer, unpaid role.
That's correct.
Is substantial, and unlike other congregations who have paid professional leaders, that's a very different way of organizing.
It is. I mean, it's not something you seek, and it's not something you say no to, as I said.
Right.
But when you're asked, you start to have to think about yourself in a different way, mm-hmm. and you start to realize, no, that there are people who really do appreciate when you voluntarily share what sorts of things have worked for you and what sorts of things can help them, not in a pushy way, you know, not in a
right. And it's more what might rather than what will.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that really sort of changed, and it wasn't just I realized that you know, sort of affected what I was doing in a lot of different realms of my life. Professionally, I started to realize, you know, those, you know, I'm a professor at Cornell, and I started to realize there were a lot of people sort of early in their career who really could benefit from a few ideas as to how to you know, get down the road.
This is the issue to think about.
Yeah, this is,
or an issue to think about.
Yeah. This is how you, this is how you organize your professional life. These are things you should think about in balancing your professional life with the rest of your life. Right. Those sorts of things. Nobody really trains you on those things.
No, and we don't look at work in an apprenticeship model where you would be mentored.
Right.
If we looked at it that way, if we looked at we had to become the people we need to be by very intentionally forming ourselves, which is also a spiritual model. This is one of the issues of our time. You brought some music with you, and this is wonderful. Do you want to describe it and introduce it?
Or? Sure. So this music that I composed probably about the time I was 18. From the time I was about 14 until I was 19, I played around in several punk bands, hardcore punk bands in Washington D.C. This is a great clip. If you have anybody listening who's into the punk scene, you'll recognize the singer. It's John Stabb, who he was the lead singer for Government Issue, a relatively big punk band. You probably won't recognize him just from his playing, but there's also a well-known guitar player in here, Andrew Charnico, who had been in several big hardcore bands around DC.
And this was your band.
I mean, this was my band. I put this together, like I said, right around the time I was 18.
Wow. Well, here we go. And this one's called Sincerity City. Is there want to say anything about the song specifically, or just play it?
For me, it's just music. The words and everything else, that's John.
Okay. Here we go.
Wake up. Kiss my past. I know a place is
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest today is David Just. So, David, tell me, what were some of the experiences that you look back on now in your life that it were really important to shape what you value now and to help you to live into the person that you that you're striving to be?
So, great question. I guess when I think about the things that sort of made me who I am, of course there are things all along the way, but what I think is sort of the key thing. Early in my life, my mother and father had pretty significant difficulties in their marriage. My mother is bipolar, and that created its own set of issues, just in terms of how the household was run and what I could expect when I would get home from school as a kid.
What you would find when you,
I mean, it was, you never quite knew what home you were coming to home to, right? And it was probably, about when I was 10, my mom left us. And, I did have contact with her all throughout growing up, but I was raised primarily by my father. And it created all sorts of conflicts for me as a teenager, and because she had a very different philosophy of life, and when she left, she didn't just leave my father; she left basically everything, right? So her belief system changed. Her everything about her seemed to change.
Which is one of the things that happens often with bipolar, these dramatic moves. Was she on medication, or did it work, or did it matter? Or
so they never in that area they could never find medication that would work.
Yeah.
And I guess to reveal the ending from the beginning, she's as she's gotten older, the bipolar has subsided somewhat,
mm-hmm.
and she's just where she was off the rails for a long, long time,
mm-hmm.
she's back on the rails, and we have extremely good relationship at this point. But right then, it was a real struggle.
Right. What did it force you to do that you wouldn't have done otherwise?
Well, there were a number of things. I mean, first off, being raised by my father, who was, a very hard worker, I didn't see him a whole lot. I didn't have a whole lot of parenting.
Right. So you parented yourself.
To a certain extent. I don't want to, I guess I don't want to diminish my father's role,
No, but I mean, you had to play an extra role with you. I mean, my father died when I was seven, and one of the things that happens to boys who lose a parent in those times is they often become more demanding of themselves than they would if they'd actually had a parent there.
Yeah. And I think that's a good way to put it. The key all happened right around 14. My mother, I still had a lot of contact with her at that point, and she was pushing me to leave the church. She was pushing me to engage in lifestyles that were very common at the time. I was growing up in Washington, D.C.
In the 80s.
In the 90s. Yeah. This would have been late 80s.
Yeah.
And so pushing me to be sort of one of the crowd, and my father was pushing me the exact opposite direction. It would be, to double down on my faith. And his example at the time was pretty amazing to me. I still look back on it, where he remained very faithful throughout all these sort of terrible things that were happening to him. His wife leaving him, having to raise me. I had a sister who had some real problems at the same time.
Older or younger?
Older. She's about 3 years older than I am.
Yeah.
And his brother swindled his mother about this time, so he ended up having to take care of his mother and his brother, who ran out of money after he swindled her. So you see this man who has the weight of the world on his shoulders, and he has this incredible faith that sort of pushes him forward. And I guess at some point I came to a crisis of my own faith and said, I've got to decide which side am I on. And I spent a good long time in prayer and studying scripture, and I just remember at some point feeling, you need to follow the better example. You need to become something much better than you would if you just let it all go.
Right. Right.
And that's about the time when I can't say my life turned 180 degrees, but at the same time, I sort of had a direction at that point.
Right. what made it, it sounds like you made peace with yourself. What did that look like?
Well, okay, so 14, to give you a bit of a timeline, I that 10 to 13 range, I felt like my world came apart, mm-hmm. and I mm-hmm. couldn't identify which...
And you're probably pretty angry.
I was pretty angry. I think getting into punk music was actually part of this, right? And by 13, I was playing club gigs and started touring and things like that at around 14, and making recordings. And I sort of, you know, to a certain extent, I could sort of see my life could become just hanging out with people, making music and you know, having fun.
Right.
Right. Or I could use my life to do other things, to do the things that I was seeing my father do at that point. Mm-hmm. And that was, to me, some of the struggle. And I really enjoyed what I was doing, but I wasn't sure if it was something I could do forever or should do forever.
Right, right. And I guess the question that comes to my, the music we're going to play is in honor of the life that you had with the punk music. And also, I imagine, the influence of your mother to some extent.
Yeah.
This is a way of honoring them both. Did your father, or does your father, enjoy the complexity of his life? Because to take care of people who are inept at taking care of themselves, or who are unable to take care of themselves,
right,
or who are malicious,
yeah,
that's a tough road to hoe. And how did he manifest pleasure or satisfaction?
I guess that was the thing that really astounded me through all of it, and which really sort of brought me to that point is at each turn where it seemed like he was being taken advantage of, or he was, you know, and one more thing was being heaped on his back, it didn't seem to bother him. I mean, it didn't depress him. Yeah, it didn't. He didn't get depressed. He continued to work. He continued to plodder along. He found happiness in the little things that we could do, the fun things that we could, you know.
What were some of the things that you did for fun?
He would take me, so he was a professor at the University of Maryland.
Uh-huh.
And he would take me to physics lectures, believe it or not. Yeah, we found that to be extremely fun.
Yeah, I mean, you're hanging out with your dad.
But so we'd do things like that. It was an odd time where for a time it was me and him and we were alone. And believe it or not, music was also one way we related to each other. I learned guitar because he left his guitar sitting out, and I picked it up and tried to pick out songs that he had played and I had heard. And so we had a music room in our house, and we would often go and just jam for hours on end together. There's just a lot of fun things happened just in that short period of time. Even while there were a whole bunch of horrible things going on in our lives, right?
Yeah. You're looking back at this, you know, at some distance.
Yeah.
when did your ability to remember the pain and the suffering that came with that align with a sense of purpose that doesn't make it right, but it makes it meaningful?
I guess that's still happening. I mean, I mean,
you are the age between 35 and 45, from my experience, where that happens often.
Yeah. I think along the line, you know, at points where I, you know, where I faced these decisions, which way do I go?
Right.
At each of those points, I've certainly reflected back on that time and sort of thought to myself, how do I develop that sort of happiness and resilience mm-hmm. that I saw my father have? And I realized it's a lot of serving other people. It's a lot of doing the things that are going to, you know, they're going to make me feel happy about myself by the time I go to bed that night.
Right.
And not necessarily the things that are just going to, I don't know, give myself make myself a more famous economist or whatever it might be.
Right, they're not gonna pad your career.
Yeah.
And they're also not gonna throw the focus on you.
Yeah, Yeah, I think that's safe to say. And we've you know, just even in the last few years, I've started to think through and my career and its balance with the rest of my life, and tried to think, how do I keep this career under control so that I do have the time I want to do the things for my children, for mm-hmm. my wife, and for other people I know that I feel responsible for.
Right. I want to cut to music now. This has been an incredibly intense segment, and I want to just take a little break from it and then come back to how it is you see opportunities to be useful. But first, let's cut to music. What wounds, demons, my degeneration? I mean, we've got lots of good punk music here, so what should we play next?
Let's do Wound.
Okay, here we go. It just takes me a second to get it up.
Yeah. You say you got no social life. You say you got no social life. It's my music and it is my wife. Always the tears of a finding jobs of all the security and the falling cross. Heal our world. Time to sing a different tune. Will it ever come too soon? We'll all be ready. Rid of our world. All of my world. Still feel like I've been betrayed. Still feel like I've been betrayed. All the plans of mice and men are made. They say the show must go on, but the fun is over and all the joy is gone. Social life.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest is David Just. So David, coming out of that experience with your sister, I want to talk about what it means to help. But I think you've learned some things from that experience that maybe we need to attend to first. What have you learned?
Well, I guess one thing that comes to mind. So throughout those years, my mother being bipolar, she was very volatile. When she was in certain states, I remember she would weekly we were supposed to go out, have dinner, do something,
interact. To spend time with her. Yeah.
And I think about 80% of the time, somewhere between when I got in her car and when we got out of the neighborhood, she would have turned and gotten really angry at me, right? And started cursing at me and just turn around and drop me off. And so, I mean, it's a horrible feeling at the time.
Yeah. 80% of the time means like maybe once a month, maybe you got to go with her.
That's about right.
It was about
once a month. And it was, you could never predict what you would say that was going to set her off. Yeah. I, I came to realize that what she was doing was not necessarily her, right? And that she had a love for me that was not something she could always express. And there were things going on in her life that prevented her, in her body even, that prevented her from being exactly who she was.
Who she would have wanted to show herself to you as.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's ended up being something, a lesson that has helped me out over and over and over again, because to usually a lesser extent, you run into people who are in a situation like that all the time. Yeah. People I've served in my church callings, people I've interacted with at work, you know, everywhere you look, you run into people who here and there are not necessarily behaving the way they really intend or the way they really feel, and you need to learn to look past it and serve them despite that, right?
Right, right, right. And I want to play with your metaphor here just a little bit.
Okay.
Because the devil's in the details, and so are the angels, and if you want to continue the metaphor. But you look past it but you still see it.
Oh yeah,
and you address it in as much as you can, but it's limited, and it's not the focus, it's not the purpose, and we sometimes, you know, looking past is not denying,
yeah,
it's just not letting it control how you respond.
I think that's exactly right. I've got a friend, elderly lady who suffers from really severe anxiety. Mm-hmm. And her anxiety manifests itself in ways where she can be hypercritical of people who are helping her at the time.
Take them apart. Yes, I've seen it many times.
And it's, you know, as I was, you know, I developed this relationship with her while I was leading this congregation here in Ithaca. And I remember there being many, many in our congregation who just did not want to go near her, did not consider it a good thing. It is sort of like they thought of it as indulging her in some way to serve her when she was behaving like this.
Yeah.
And I guess I just didn't see it that way from my experience. I realized, no, she's saying these things, but she needs our help.
Right. And they're not good, and we cannot take them personally.
Yeah.
But that is not a reason for denying her what she needs.
That's right. And I mean, you know, I feel like I do need to encourage her. Yeah, you probably should be somewhat thankful and a little mm-hmm. a little less obstinate when people are helping you. But at the same time, we need to help.
Right. And what you just said, you can't make that claim on her. And it's a claim. It's a moral claim on her to think about being differently until you have a relationship with her that's strong enough to bear the message.
That's a great point. That's a great point. Because I now also get the comment that she treats me differently than she treats other people. And
well, there's a lesson there for the other people.
I think that's how it comes, right? But you do have to get through some, you know, 12 feet of concrete before you get to that relationship with her,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Being an ordained minister myself and having but not practicing with the congregation, I'm like a minister without portfolio. I kind of serve as a random chaplain in Ithaca and Tompkins County on some level through shared journeys. But you learn that people throw darts for a whole host of reasons.
Yeah.
And if you let them eviscerate you or you let them stick, then you're probably not going to go someplace. Now, people around you may wonder, what are you doing? You know, what in God's name are you doing? But the primacy is that people need people. And if we can, in whatever way, be those people without damaging ourselves, and that's the key thing, is that, you know, if you step away because they're ugly and they're mean, then you've damaged them, perhaps, especially if you could have stepped up without damaging yourself. Now, right. If you're going to damage yourself, you need to step back, because that would be stupid. That would be morally irresponsible.
Yeah, I mean, and to be honest, you will run into people who are in these circumstances who will ask everything of you.
And you can't do it.
Yeah.
But you need to say, well, this is what I can do, and this is what I can't do, and this is what I can't do now, but I might.
But this is how I got into this. Yeah. In fact, is because I, like I said, one of my driving principles is I don't say no.
Right.
And she's very good at taking advantage of that.
Right. And the thing is, I mean, you and I have the same story on a certain level, in that I learned in my... well, I come from rural poverty, and I kind of married into middle class, certain affluence, and have an Ivy League, you know, education and PhD and MDiv seminary and all this stuff. And I am aware of a lot of the contradictions, and I feel a kind of pain and anger that people are only seeing expressed now in our political sphere that I have felt from the time I left the farm in 1976, or even when I was an exchange student earlier, when I was in Colombia, where I had more in common with the campesinos working on the coffee plantation than I did with the family that I was living with.
Right.
And so there's a level of anger and pain that made me become hostile. And I would say, no, that's not right, or no, I don't want to do that. But no had become, in a certain sense, my default. And to save my soul, I had to say to myself, you have to find a way to say yes, unless there's something that's really going to harm you. And I didn't learn to say no when the harm was there, because I would take risks too much too soon in life to try to be with or in stuff that were, you know, fairly dangerous, both physically and emotionally. It's a hard won lesson, and it's a lesson that you learn when you choose it. And people who say, I'm not going to have anything to do with that person, they're not ready for the lesson, but when they're ready to figure it out, they can choose it.
Yeah. I think that's right. And you know, to a certain extent, that all the things that might be making you angry, those things don't, you know, your mind doesn't change. Yeah. But there seems to be, but there's a lot more power in saying yes in some sense, in that you really can change the world a lot more by engaging, by, you know, by talking and by doing than you can by just pushing off and saying no.
Right, right. And this brings up another, there is a prophetic voice. And if you want to make change, a lot of that has been associated with negativity. And even a lot of the 60s and 70s civil rights and stuff and Vietnam was all about negativity. It was not about affirming all of the people so we could come forward to be in a different place together. And now we are reaping the results of that negativity on both sides. And I still have in myself a strong prophetic voice, which I wrestle with. How do you use it and use it positively? And there are no easy answers.
No, I don't think there are easy answers. To me, that's really a pretty deep question as to how you go about encouraging the things that you want, you know, seeing the things that you'd like to see happen out in the world. And I guess it's my Mormon upbringing. We feel very strongly that the contention is evil. Right. Mm-hmm. And that means when you do go about trying to change the world, you do it through encouraging, through kindness, through long suffering. You don't do it through, shouting and screaming. Right. That's not to denigrate anybody for the way they're getting their message out. It's just I have this really deep feeling that I don't join protests.
Right. Right. And people shout and scream either because they've been hurt.
Yeah.
Or because they anticipate they have to do that to move somebody.
Yeah.
This is actually going to help us. I would look for, I respect the effort that the LDS Church and Mormons make to keep peaceful and civil discourse. But one of the things that I learned in seminary was that was with the body metaphor, which is in scripture. The body without tension is a corpse until rigor sets in. The body only operates because there are creative and productive conflicts and tensions that take place within it.
Right.
And we must nurture those in ways that keep us moving forward and not deny them, because we will kill ourselves if we either get too conflicted or try to squelch all conflict.
There's a trade-off there. I mean, to say that we don't want contention is not to say everybody has to think the same way.
And that's often the message that does not get heard within the Mormon tradition.
I think that's true, and it's something that we, you know, I believe the church has been trying to say. I know at least I've been trying to say it. We don't all have to think the same way, but we need to sit next to each other in the pews and support each other.
Right, and when we need to wrestle productively, we'll wrestle.
Well, yeah, I mean, we can share our thoughts. We can share our views, and you know, we are going to face differences of opinion that at time are going to resemble conflict, whether we want it there or not.
Uh-huh. Right, right. But if I, and this is where the enemy language and love language can go together, and that's so hard for people to believe. But anyone who has been married and intimately married knows that the two go hand in hand at times.
Yeah.
I want to use this to segue to where I had actually hoped to go. And that is when you're helping, or when you're being a partner to your spouse, or a parent to your children, when you're in some sense trying to be helpful, there is, like you say, we want to impact the world with what we see the world needs, but we also want to merely do what others believe they need, because they have to learn.
Yeah.
How have you come to understand what is productive help? I mean, and as a church leader, you've got what is helpful versus what is your ego or what is their ego that's getting in the way? You know, how do you discern? What are the lessons you've learned about being helpful?
I guess to me, there's always going to be a trade-off.
Being an economist, that makes perfect sense.
That's exactly right. In my experience, but as a parent, as well as somebody leading a congregation, when people come to me with problems, whether they're spiritual, whether they need money, whatever it might be, so certainly there is almost always some element of this person is facing this problem to a certain extent because of the decisions they've made and the things that they've mm-hmm. done. I guess you have to have some bit of judgment as to how do I help them, you know, in the best way for their long run well-being. I mean, I always felt like I needed to make sure people were fed. I needed to make sure people had heat and things of that nature. But then I also needed to make sure they had some way to see hope of getting out there on their own two feet eventually. And that's, you know, that means creatively saying no in some ways that don't hurt them.
Yes, in ways that the things that they maybe think are fantasies that they can't, dreams that they can't have.
I learned a whole lot from there's a wonderful man who was in our congregation, passed away a couple years ago, Bill Mobbs. And he was amazing at working with people who were in financial troubles, because he would sit down and he would think through, here are the sort of key pieces that'll get this family or this individual to be sustainable on their own. And it would almost always involve several different things at once. It was an insolvable puzzle. They'd gotten into a really
difficult bind.
A bind that they just could not get out of on their own.
Right.
And so he would set in place, cooperate with me, and we'd set in place the pieces that were necessary. And then one of two things would happen. Either all the pieces were there and they, you know, things were fine and they had just gotten themselves into a bind, or else suddenly you'd realize there was some other underlying problem that nobody was talking about,
right,
that was getting in the way. Ongoing problems with mental illness,
right,
or addiction. Addiction was big. But those things wouldn't even become evident until you had the sort of structure in place right. to be able to see it.
Right. One of the things that most people who are not familiar with the LDS or the Mormon church do not understand that the church is a social service agency yep. as well as a congregation, and sees its role as making sure that none of its members and the people that they can serve within reach outside the congregation are without what they need. And that is a level of commitment to material and emotional and spiritual well-being that most congregations haven't taken.
It's something that's ingrained in us from early on, that we have a responsibility to the other members of our church mm-hmm. and then beyond. But first primarily to primarily to our family, and secondarily to the members of the church, and then the world at large, right? And it is. It's not only, you know, just giving money to help people, it's giving time, expertise, and putting in effort to get them where they need to be. And
building the relationships that they can leverage.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And from the time you're 14, you're visiting usually three families a month and building a friendship with them, building a relationship so that if they get into trouble, they can come to you and ask for help, and you'll be there for them, and they know that, right?
And if you get into trouble,
you've got people. That's exactly right.
And where those kinds of systems sometimes break down is people don't realize that you have not matured as a leader until you've had to ask for help.
Good point. That's exactly right.
And so there was a time when I was kind of rigid about that, where I would discourage people from taking service roles unless they themselves had asked for help, and that was a little too rigid. But it is just something to keep in mind.
It can be an issue. Like, you know, you've mentioned we have a lay ministry, and we don't choose ourselves as you would. Now and again we'll end up with somebody in a leadership position who isn't very good at asking for help,
right?
And that actually makes them a much less effective leader, because they can't delegate. They can't say, well, you know, suddenly the church is only what they can accomplish on their right. own, instead of what a large group of people can accomplish together.
Right. I'm going to play with this, because this comes at some organizational behavior stuff, which, you know, organizations oftentimes who pick their leaders by lottery, randomly, or by some system that's not justified as a meritocracy, they actually are stronger because the members of the community realize that the community stands or falls on all of their participation, how they support the less than able leader, or how they challenge them appropriately. But the communities are stronger when they try to give up the notion of meritocracy. And that LDS has a discernment about gifts and graces. That's not the language that they would use, I don't believe, but it's about discerning.
It's familiar enough, yeah.
Yeah, and that's the language that's more common to most Christians. What language is it that you do use?
Well, we do talk about having, you know, being endowed with gifts, mm-hmm. Spiritual gifts,
right?
And some of those we believe come along with a calling to serve. So mm-hmm. if you are called as a bishop, is what we call the leader of a congregation,
and that's what they called the leader of a congregation in my tradition in the early part of the 19th century.
Very good,
bishop. same language. We're similar. We're very close.
So we believe there are some gifts that come along with that, but most of the spiritual gifts, you know, being able to. You know, having the gift of knowledge, or being able to teach people, or being able to understand doctrine, those things tend to follow the individual, mm-hmm. not the calling.
Right.
And so there is this sort of idea of, well, I better be prepared, because I have no idea what calling I'm going to have, you know, next week.
Yep. This is good. Let's cut to music. What should we play next? Well, we have Demons, My Degeneration, Loved One.
Let's go for My Degeneration.
Okie doke. Waiting in love and family misery. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is David Just. So, David, as we close the show, what I like for people to reflect on is how they've learned how to take care of themselves. And, you know, throughout the day, weekly, monthly, yearly, what do you do to restore your sense of balance intellectually, emotionally, physically, or your sense of skillfulness or preparedness for life?
Sure.
And how do you know you need to do it?
Well, so I guess daily, just as you know, sort of taking care of myself physically and spiritually, I've got a set routine. You know, every morning I'm up and I spend you know, basically 6 to 7 o'clock in the morning studying scripture. Right now I'm going through Ezekiel. Very interesting book.
Yes, these dry bones.
That's right. Yes. And then I follow that up with exercise for an hour, and then go to work. Those things sort of keep me. I'm an insomniac. If I don't have exercise, I don't sleep. Uh-huh. So it's necessary. And right. I find, you know, if I don't have the scripture study, I sort of lose my anchor on the day, right? I don't know. It just feels different,
right?
But beyond that, I think the thing that is really, really central to survival and some of what I, you know, to any extent that I got what my father had in terms of that, you know, that foundation and being able to weather storms, it's the family.
Right.
It's when a crisis comes, I know I can go spend time with my family, and I've got an uplifting place that's you know, it's my sanctuary.
Right. And it's a place, well, sanctuary. It's a safe place. It's a comforting place. Uplifting is the word you used. I would imagine on a good time it's uplifting, and there are times when it just hugs each other for dear life.
Yes. When we, you know, when you hit the rough patches out in the world, the family's there.
Yeah.
That's not to say when, you know, when things are going well outside, the family's pretty good at bickering and doing other things that are sort of normal, but
yeah.
But when you need them, they're there.
Right.
And that's you know, that's one thing that I value more than probably anything else, especially sort of given my upbringing and just the lack of the center or you know, anchor when I was growing up.
Right. I think one of the things that's really striking about your story is the emotional upheaval to go through with a parent with bipolar disorder forces you to learn a kind of emotional intelligence that maybe other people wouldn't. And it's not, and the stereotype of Mormons are that they are emotionally rather monochromatic, peaceful,
yeah.
And that's not true.
it's not in, well, I mean, so
I mean, the stereotype is there, but
yeah,
but,
if you took a snapshot of all of us on Sunday in church, it's true.
Yeah.
I think once we leave the building, it's gone.
Yeah. And so how are you able to nurture that emotional awareness that despair is not the ultimate thing, that anger is a signal that something needs to be addressed, that you can be a little conniving and have fun and that's just fine, or how do you cultivate the whole instrument of your emotional life?
I guess to me I have the aspiration of what I want to achieve and a practical realization that I'm not going to get there very quickly.
If at all, yes.
And that means, I have to be tolerant of my weaknesses. I have to be tolerant of, if I'm going to have weaknesses, I'm going to be tolerant of my weaknesses. I've got to tolerate other people's too.
Right.
That doesn't mean that, now and again, I won't read into what somebody is saying or how they're acting towards me a lot more than I really should. But usually that night I'll sit down and before I go to bed, I'll realize, well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I probably should be giving them the benefit of the doubt.
Right. Right. And you've taken the question in terms of how do you deal with those kind of in your face experiences that are hard. What I'm also asking about is a little bit like where you started out. How do you have fun? Because the emotional life depends on a certain amount of fun.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, I think fun is actually very key to it. Creating that home space that is a sanctuary means you need to have had a good number of hours spent, doing things that are fun and building those relationships. Otherwise, they won't be there, right?
Right.
So,
what do you do for fun?
So, I love playing music with my own kids, but I love doing just about anything. We spent last Friday up at a trampoline park in Syracuse because my youngest kid has been begging for it, and it was fun. It wasn't it wouldn't have been top on my list, but it's there.
Right. You did what he wanted to do.
That's right.
And now he may not want to do it again, or he might.
Yeah, I'm guessing he'll probably want it.
Yeah.
But we try to schedule hours of time every week in which we're going to have some sort of fun, skiing, playing board games. We'll play video games together. We don't do a lot of TV, but when we do TV, we do it together, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the types of things we try to make sure we have good amount of experience with each other.
Right. And it's a mix of physical activity and intellectual activity. And I imagine from what you're saying, you're processing it together at the same time.
It's the hope.
Yeah. But if you don't have the occasions, if you don't create the venues, then the hope may go unrealized.
So it is very easy to let other things take over.
Yep.
There are plenty of other things that will take it over if you do not, I was giving this advice to a friend of mine very recently. When they asked about work-life balance, this is somebody in my professional career. Mm-hmm. I said, "You've got to fight for this the same way you do any career goal you might have, and in fact, more, because it's much more important, right? If you don't have this, your career goals are not going to mean anything at the end of the day. You can't turn to your career accomplishments in your time of need and seek solace.
Right.
It's not going to be there.
What jazzes your mind?
I'm a geek. I got into computer programming as a very little kid, and I still love programming and hacking. I spent the last month rigging my home as a smart home. my kids and my wife hate me at this point for having done it, but
yes.
To the point
the demon
where
cannot be undone.
That's right. I mean, I spent a good hour hacking my heating system so that I could control it with my voice.
Right.
Which was fun, but to the point now where several of us in our house, there's music that plays automatically as we enter the house. So we have our own theme songs, if you will.
Right. And it knows when you're coming in.
It knows when we're coming in. That's right. It's yeah. So my theme is the Imperial March from Star Wars.
You have a sense of humor.
Oh, it's fun.
Yeah. David, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
I've enjoyed it. This is great.
And we're going to close with a piece called Loved One. Do you want to say anything about it?
It's just one that I really enjoy and reminds me a lot of the singer who just happened to pass away this last year, John Stabb.
John, okay.
God! football season's over for Hacker. Kurt and Ram had nothing to offer the school but date rapes and AIDS jokes.
Walking into a funeral that guests the dyer's cast. Sometimes it was tuneful.
Touchdown!